think Tevez going to Juventus, what a coup that was for me. I mean,
on a head-to-head battle, Atletico Madrid can do more damage to Barcelona than the other way around.
Either he's really blind or he's fixing the match. I can't see it any other way.
I'm trying to get Sir Bob on my side here by saying City will win the Premier League.
It is an upset. You would expect Man United to go and win there.
Over $1 billion was paid in transfer fees between the clubs in Europe.
It's football. It's damn football. Like Ferguson said, football. Bloody marvellous.
Yeah, well, the celebration was, I can't believe I just scored against Mexico.
At one point, Parma, I think it's only like 224 players under contract.
Hey, they're going to throw me out of here, fellas. You're going to get me arrested on your show.
If you're a serious talent, you're going back and you're playing for Santos. You know, you're going back to play for, like in Argentina, for River Plate or Boca Juniors. Or you're going to Europe.
He looked like the Ryan Giggs of old. He was more creative than any player on the pitch. He made Mata look stupid. He made Rooney look silly.
Now, the Premier League is what the most exciting league out there. I think it's probably the best marketed league without a question.
When you look at the draw for the Champions League, you kind of say, well, all the pieces kind of fell into place for everybody except City.
I am your host, Joe Uccello.
Sir Bob, Mike Orr. My co-host, Rob Rojas.
My trusted co-host, Ben the Machine.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to episode 300 of Low Limit Football on this 11th of October, 2020. I am your host, Joe Uccello, and tonight, the international break is in full swing as the transfer window is finally closed. Ben Olsen is sacked at DC United after 10 years on the job, and we're going to look at World Cup qualifiers from CONMEBOL with the BBC's very own Tim Vickery, who will be joining us in just a minute. But first, let me get my co-host in here, Mr. Roberto Rojas. How are you, my man?
I'm doing well, Joe. Happy 300.
Happy 300 indeed, my friend. It's, you know, it's amazing. We just had our seven-year anniversary just, it seemed like yesterday, but it's actually, believe it or not, just over a month ago. And now we've crossed the 300 line. So I guess we'll keep on trucking along and keep on posting podcasts and keep doing our thing, right?
100%.
Absolutely. So, you know, we're going to get into it with Tim Vickery in a second, you know, having him on the show, which we always enjoy having him. But I want to ask you, what are your initial thoughts on the opening week of qualifying for CONMEBOL?
Well, certainly I don't think we should dive in into, actually, you know what? We will.
Okay.
We should dive in.
A little bit.
Yeah, just a little bit. I'll mention what happened on the pitch. I think we saw teams that I feel are prepared for these type of games. I think, you know, these are the hardest World Cup qualifiers in the world, no doubt about it. I think a lot was made about how these guys would cross the Atlantic and go to South America, and actually would like your take on this being more of a health expert in this case, is like trying to maintain these players in kind of a bubble and trying to get them without hopefully getting exposed to the virus when they do come back to their respective leagues. I mean, obviously we did see a few cases of players that got COVID and therefore had to leave the squad. Not a lot, but there is something there. So this could be a risk for a lot of teams, and it could potentially mean missing some of their stars that could affect their matches when they do take the pitch.
Sure, absolutely. You know, it's hard to maintain that social distancing and everything you need, and where these teams are you know, when we talk about the teams, I'm talking about their club teams, have kind of attempted to maintain that level of bubble or insulation versus the players, you know, potentially contracting the virus. And now you're actually sending them out into the world, and then you're going to bring them back in. And you're sending them into a part of the world that right now, if you look at Brazil, one of the most dangerous areas in the world in terms of COVID, you know, you're sending them into that type of scenario. So it's going to be interesting to see how these players maintain their level of safety, or how the clubs or how the organizations maintain their level of safety. And when they're returned, do we see cases start to prop up in Italy and in Spain and in England? you know, do we see things like that start to happen? Because that could be very, very concerning. And I mean, this is really the litmus test, right? It's one thing to have Italy play the Netherlands, which is coming up this week, because those teams kind of stay in Europe. The travel is very restricted. Do you know what I mean? Everything's in close quarters. You're sending them halfway around the world when you're sending them to Argentina or you're sending them to Bolivia or Chile. And I think there is a larger risk going over to South America than there would be going into these national teams where these players, you know, and I'm going to take Italy, for example, but even Spain, many of these players are playing in Spain. So they're staying in Spain. They're going to the national team. I think there's a little bit of a better level of safety for the European teams to go to their international duties and then come back as there is to the South American team. So we'll have to see if something does come up. We won't know probably, Rob, for what, a couple weeks, right? You know, at least a week or two before we start to see anything that may have come of this. But hopefully things go off well, because I think this is a great litmus test. If things do go well and we do see minimal cases or none at all, which hopefully is the case, then I think it's a testament to the South American federations and what they did to insulate those players. It's a testament to the players and their travel. And it could be a textbook on how to, you know, reintegrate into their international sides during the international breaks, and a playbook that maybe, you know, some of the North American teams will follow. I know Mexico's got a couple of friendlies, but the United States national team has not, they've not come together at all since before COVID. And so it's going to be interesting to see if those, if there's a playbook developed based on the experiences and then how that's implemented among the other world FAs. So I think
you're and just going in, I think also it's important because there's another World Cup qualifier window next month. So obviously it plays into that whole kind of time span when the players return back to their respective teams and then have to go back in the next couple of weeks as well.
Exactly. I couldn't agree with you more. So before we jump in, because that actually wasn't opening thoughts, but it was kind of follow up on our discussion with Tim. Let's we do have a trivia question. You, my friend, have the question, so it is your honor, Your Honor.
Yes. So in celebration of our 300 episode, I figured we talk about two of the most important players of, well, at least the time of us following soccer, in Messi and Ronaldo. Mm-hmm. And the question is, for both of these players, they scored their 300 goals respectively, one at Barcelona and one at Real Madrid, okay, being Messi at Barcelona, Cristiano Ronaldo at Real Madrid. What year did both these players score their 300 career goal?
Oh, and you're basically, by wording it that way, they both scored their 300th goals at the same in the same year.
In the same calendar year, not same season, same calendar.
Right.
Yep.
And I think,
which is incredible, actually, given that they scored so many goals. But both of them have scored their 300 career goal in this year.
Okay. All right. I've got a guesstimate. Because both of them are now, I believe, in the 700s. I do have a guesstimate. And I'll give that to you at the end of the show. So.
Yep. And I gave you a hint saying that both, one was at Barcelona, the other was at Real Madrid. So obviously that doesn't mean that Ronaldo scored in Portugal, in Manchester United, or at Juventus, United. And Messi didn't score in Argentina. So right. That's your hint.
Awesome. All right. So we'll get it at the end of the show, hopefully. Let's go into opening thoughts. Opening thoughts is just basically a reflection of the transfer window, which closed this week. Rob, I was looking back comparing, you know, this is obviously a transfer window like no other transfer window given the pandemic. And I went back and looked at the statistics of the 2019 transfer window. And The Guardian is a great place to look up this stuff because they have all the moves that are listed over the past couple of years. Last year's summer transfer window, Rob, believe it or not, 1,932 deals, 5.25 billion pounds was moved in the transfer window, and that's 2019. 2020, which we expected this, saw a significant decline on both ends, 1,380 deals. So you're looking at 600 less transfer deals happening in the window 2019 to 2020, and by dollar amount, 2.99 billion pounds. So almost 2 billion, actually more than 2 billion pounds less that was spent the previous year. So we've seen a significant drop in a lot of, and we anticipated this. We've talked about it quite a bit. The big moves, the amounts of money, all of that stuff. We've seen a massive decrease in all of those things. Coming into this, what were your thoughts on how many of these transfers happened? I mean, we talk about the Arthur move where it's money and players and it kind of, you know, the money washes itself off. What were your thoughts on this particular transfer window this year? Because it was a very strange one comparatively.
It was, and obviously it's due to the circumstances that we did see that, but I think ultimately we did see a lot of transfers that were maybe not as highly valued, with an exception. Mm-hmm. So personally, I think it was something that was expected. I mean, certainly the saga and the whole silly season always tries to get the worst out of everyone, really. But, you know, we didn't see that high profile transfer occur. I think everyone was wondering if Manchester United were going to break the bank and get Jadon Sancho from Borussia Dortmund. That didn't happen. You know, the only biggest fee that we saw was the Kai Havertz move, and that was only 80 million euros, which, let's be fair, Joe, that's a bargain nowadays in the current transfer window that we're living in. So, yeah, I mean, certainly we didn't see anything big occur. And obviously, as we said, you know, the whole pandemic kind of allowed teams to be a bit more pragmatic in how their spending is going to be used. I do see that there are a lot of loans as well. I mean, we do see a lot of comebacks. You know, Gareth Bale returning to England. I mean, you know, you have obviously a lot of players that are so highly rated finally getting a move. So like Donny van de Beek, Timo Werner, Arthur, as you mentioned. But I mean, it's an interesting window, I should say, but maybe one that doesn't have that high profile one. I mean, this isn't to say that none of these players that were transferred are not world class. I mean, certainly there are a lot of them out there, but, you know, there was not a big one that perhaps broke the bank and made everyone change their mind. Maybe the one was going to be Sancho, but ultimately that didn't occur this summer.
Yeah. You know, the according to The Guardian, the biggest move that happened this year was actually Victor Osimhen moving from Lille to Napoli for 73 million pounds. You know, and that's, even that one is kind of surprising. I don't think at the beginning of the transfer window, you would have said that would have been the biggest move made in the transfer window. But, you know, here we are, and it was. I was surprised to see a lot of the players leaving the German Bundesliga. You know, you mentioned Kai Havertz. You know, we saw Timo Werner also leave RB Leipzig. We've seen Weston McKennie leaving Schalke, going to Juve on a loan. And you bring up another great point, Rob, where you're saying we've seen a lot of loan moves. You know, and just in, for example, for Juventus, right? Weston McKennie is actually in on a loan. Alvaro Morata came over on a loan. Federico Chiesa, which was just at the end of the transfer window, comes over on a loan. Now, many of these loans are loans with options to buy. They're you know, in the case of Chiesa, it's actually a 2-year loan, and then I believe an obligation to buy at the end of it. So it had COVID's caused the or forced these teams to become a little more creative in terms of their transfers, you know, and things like that. Now that we're getting back, though, to we're on the path to normalcy. I'm going to call it that, Rob, because it's not going to be truly normal for quite some time. But we are on the road. We're starting to see fans back in stadiums. We're starting to see tickets being sold and that sort of thing. This was obviously a very unusual transfer window. You know, again, like we've said, the way moves were made, the types of moves that were made, the loans, that sort of thing. Usually the winter window is a quiet window. It's usually something that we don't see many major moves, or if we even see a major move made, like in the case of Christian Pulisic, it was a move made in January, but wasn't completed until the summer, and Dortmund kept Pulisic until the summer. And if you remember, Chelsea kind of escaped the transfer window ban by getting Pulisic before they were banned for that one time. So for me, I'm anticipating that maybe come in the winter, if, you know, depending on how the finances are, again, this is a very fluid situation in terms of the world and what's going on. But do you feel that the winter window could be crazier or busier than the summer window, strictly because of where we might be in terms of handling this pandemic in the December / January window? Could we see something like that, Rob? Do you think that maybe there's more money spent? I mean, £3 billion is significant. It's not chump change, but I think there's potential that if the right moves are made, if the right teams are advancing in Champions League and that sort of thing, and they need that extra big piece, you could potentially see a team go out and spend some serious cash, and maybe we do have a bigger winter window than we do a summer window. What are your thoughts of that?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, it all depends on how it's going to be obviously organized in relation to this whole pandemic and whatnot. So it's possible. I mean, certainly you don't want it to happen, because I think teams want to understand that they want to be at full strength for the entire season, and they don't want to lose a key player midway through the season, but that's always been the case for a lot of teams. But I think ultimately where they can feel as if though they've saved enough money that they can go and spend it for that kind of winter transfer window. It's all dependent, obviously, on like what a team needs, if players are injured or unfortunately, God forbid, sick because of the virus. Maybe they do need that kind of reinforcement needed. So certainly it'll be interesting to see how that all pans out within the next few months, but it'd be possible. I mean, I don't really see it happening too much personally, but again, it'll all be dependent on that necessity that teams need. And more importantly, if they have the finances to go in and get something. But I think it'll remain the same, honestly, Joe, if you're going to give me like a gun to the head kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I think it will remain quiet as well, and that the big spending will probably happen next year when the whole competitions occur with the Euros, Copa America, World qualifiers, where a player is could be more assessed and highly valued than ever before.
Right. Last question for you before we close this out. Is there one move or one player that made a move in this window that you are interested or excited to see how they get on with their new club? For me, I do have a move that, and I guess I'll go first. For me, it's Hakim Ziyech, to see how he gets on at Chelsea. I think there's some serious attacking options at Chelsea, and we've seen what he was able to do at Ajax before making that move. So for him, maybe he's not the flashiest of moves, although he is one of the top moves that was made. But I think for me, I'm interested to see how he gets on at Chelsea and how he manages in the Champions League, but the Premier League, because he was such a dynamic piece of that Ajax side a couple years ago that I think it'll be interesting to see that next level. So for me, Ziyech is definitely that one. How about for you? Is there a particular move that you're like, yeah, I can't wait to see how this guy gets on?
Well, actually, it's good that you mentioned Chelsea, because I'm going to pick his teammate, Timo Werner. I think certainly Chelsea have always been trying to find that main top goal scorer that they haven't had in quite some time. We all know what Werner's talent has demonstrated when he was playing at Leipzig in the Bundesliga. So obviously there's no doubt on what he's able to do, but it will be interesting to see how he catches up and matches up, but also how he connects well with, obviously, Ziyech, Havertz as well. Mm-hmm. And it'll be interesting. So, yeah. Obviously, I think the big moves that happened over the summer are the ones to watch out for in Chelsea. Certainly, they made a lot of moves that would hopefully warrant themselves into contending for major trophies in England. And it'll be interesting to see if Werner is able to be that kind of productive goal scorer that we've been accustomed to for quite some time, and if he's someone that fits in the system that Lampard's trying to do. So if I have to choose one, I think it's Timo Werner and how he does at Chelsea.
Chelsea with a net spend in this window of £152 million, certainly one of the biggest transfer bills in the summer. So. Let's table that discussion and let's get into World Cup qualifying and matches that have been played. So you and I were fortunate enough to have Tim Vickery come back to the show just right before we recorded and discuss the qualifiers in round one of CONMEBOL. So without further ado, the Tim Vickery interview. joining us now on Low Limit Football from the BBC, Mr. Tim Vickery. Tim, welcome back to the show. Always a pleasure to have you on and have you on to look at World Cup qualifiers in CONMEBOL. I want to kick off with the Brazil match, 5-0 over Bolivia, quite convincing for Brazil in terms of the goal scoring line. And I really want to open with a question on Renan Lodi, the left back that played for them for Brazil. He had a fantastic match, one of the best players on the pitch the entire night. And you look at Brazil and their depth at left back with Telles, with Alexandro. You could even, if you wanted to call in an aging Marcelo, you could. Is Renan Lodi the choice right left back for Brazil now, or is it something where it could be managed player by player?
No, it's him. I don't think there's any question about that. It's hard, I think, to go overboard about the Bolivia game because Bolivia was so poor. You know, Bolivia, clearly, they've left a lot of their gunpowder in La Paz for the game against Argentina, and they don't expect to pick up points away to Brazil. They do expect to pick up points at home. So we had this bizarre statistic just before Brazil took the lead on a 15-minute mark. Brazil had exchanged 118 passes and Bolivia had exchanged 3. So it's difficult to draw too many conclusions. But we were seeing the shell of the side that Brazil want to go forward with. And ever since that World Cup defeat to Belgium, there's been a lot of thinking going on. Maybe not all of it particularly productive. It's hard being a national team coach because, you know, when you lose a big game, you've got to wait a long, long time for other big games to come round. And even though Brazil won the Copa America last year, I don't think they were particularly great and they weren't really tested. And remember, they were held to a couple of 0-0 draws along the way. And so there's been a lot of thinking about why did they lose to Belgium? What went wrong? One of the things that the coach worried about was the way that they'd left themselves too open against Belgium, especially down the left-hand side of the field where, remember, you had Marcelo there and you got Neymar ahead of him. No one's doing very much defending down that side and Belgium came for them down that side. So, you know, the first thought was, I don't want Liverpool fullbacks anymore. I want Manchester City fullbacks. I want fullbacks who will tuck in, remain part of the defensive line and construct from deep. And that wasn't a conspicuous success. So we now have a situation where we've got that on one side of the field with the right back, but the left back has total freedom to bomb forward. Now that means that Neymar doesn't have to hug the touchline. Neymar can come in because Renan Lodi has the left flank. Neymar can come in and float inwards. How do you balance it up? Well, we've had a change of formation because instead of the 4-1-4-1, which is hard to differentiate from a 4-3-3, we now have, from the first time in this game, we had an extra, more defensively minded midfielder, Douglas Luiz of Aston Villa, who is, and his role there is to protect that left side, and mean that they're not quite so open. So now there is that balance. Renan Lodi can come in and really bomb forward. So he's the man in possession.
And certainly, it's interesting that you mentioned the left flank, because that goes into my next question. In Neymar's case, I mean, in the game, he also had a spectacular game. Two assists in the 5-0 win. And one of the things that I think I've enjoyed watching of him is, you know, him being that kind of creator. I think we all know the talent that Neymar has as a goal scorer, but also as a creator, it kind of helps him in a bit more. So how do you assess his performances and obviously now heading into that next game against Peru?
Well, he goes without saying, he's an extraordinary talent. Possibly overdid it looking for a goal against Bolivia, but as I say, Bolivia is not the measure. The measure is going to be, and look at the last four World Cups, they've gone out in the knockout stage as soon as they come up against a top ranked Western European side. There's still a lot, still despite his age, you know, there's still quite a lot of maturing to do from Neymar. The most worrying thing for me was the way that in the final of the Champions League, as soon as Paris Saint-Germain went behind, his game just collapsed. Now, that's worrying. That's a player who hasn't been prepared to lose, doesn't know how to cope with that yet. So there are many more serious tests along the way. Peru will be fascinating. I mean, in these opening two rounds of games, Brazil or Peru versus Brazil is the only time that two teams who qualified for Russia are meeting. So and Peru should, although in my view, Peru are overperforming. I'm amazed by the job that Gareca has done there. But Peru against Brazil, for me, should be one of the highlights of these first two rounds.
And it's a good segue to my next segment, because certainly we'll talk about the game that happened also on Thursday. Paraguay against Peru ended in a 2-2 draw in Asunción. I mean, certainly we saw the best and worst of both teams. Certainly, I think Gareca is trying to maintain this kind of team that he's always had for quite some time, whereas Berizzo is trying to find an idea and try to make it make sense in a way in these performances. So how do you assess both these teams, and especially in this game, what stood out to you?
Well, I wonder, and I'd love your opinion on this, Rob, whether Berizzo will work with Paraguay, whether he's a good for Paraguay. Because what he would want to do is you know, he's a Bielsa protege, he's a former Bielsa assistant. I've never thought that style sits particularly well with the Paraguayans. You know, when Martino came in, and Martino had far more knowledge of Paraguayans and Paraguayan football when he was national team coach, he went a little bit overboard, it all went disastrously wrong in the 2007 Copa America. And Martino was lucky that it was at the start of the rain and he could ride that storm. And then he developed a side. And for me, it's the greatest Paraguay side. And one of the reasons for that was that they could play both ways. Play in your half of the field and take control when it was possible. But when it wasn't, they could be Paraguay. They could defend deep and enjoy themselves. You know, the Paraguayan deep defense seems both desperate and serene at the same time. You know, when they do it well, they are a phenomenon. So I'm still not convinced that Berizzo is a good fit for what he wants to do with Paraguay. How do you see that issue?
Well, I think it's certainly a case of looking at a different identity. As you said, you know, you want to maintain those kind of virtues that Paraguay has been so successful over the years. But at the same time, they want to be assertive. And I think it's also important that they need that kind of goal, which is like that kind of eye for goal, which is something they've always struggled for. So because of that, I think because they want to change that identity and be, you know, high pressured, high intensity play in your half of the field, and go for it, it kind of just takes away from what they're accustomed to, which kind of also led to the two goals that Peru scored. So it'll be difficult to see. I mean, obviously you can't assess one game over an entire 18 game process, but there's something there. And I think if some tweaks are made defensively, where they actually maintain that kind of assertiveness of what they've been accustomed to, and to see how versatile they can go moving forward, especially when you have Almirón as that central piece, then there's something there. I mean, it will take time, but, you know, you got to convince them early on for the Paraguayans if they want to get on Berizzo's side.
And in terms of Peru, and you said that Gareca is sticking with this group, but part of that is that I don't think, you know, does he have anything else? Is there anything else there? I look at Peruvian domestic football at the moment. It's practically a joke, isn't it? And how on earth can a team like Binacional be champions of Peru? And the record of Peruvian clubs in the Libertadores over recent years is an unmitigated disaster. So I don't think he's got a great deal else. But one of his extraordinary triumphs that he's had with Peru is mentally. Toughening them up mentally, getting them to believe in themselves much more. And if you look, they didn't make France 98 on goal difference, so they were close. After that, you know, the qualification campaigns for 2002 up to 2014, they more or less lost every away game that they played, and they just collapsed time and time and time again, as soon as the first goal went in, they collapsed. They don't do that anymore. You know, they were the only side to avoid defeat on the road. Everyone else lost, and most of them lost quite heavily. So they've come back with a point, and they've denied Paraguay, who are a direct competitor for a World Cup place. They've denied 2 points there to Paraguay. So that I think is a better result for Peru than it is for Paraguay.
100%. I mean, obviously you don't want to lose points when you're leading 2-1 as well. So it's also important for them to get that point away from home. And having said that, into this next game with Uruguay and Chile, I mean, certainly Chile were hoping to get the point in Montevideo, only for Maxi Gomez to get a late winner. Certainly we understand the quality that Uruguay has and how Tavares has continued to maintain a base of players that he's been accustomed to with the new generation of players coming in. But more importantly, I think the controversy that we saw was that handball given. That wasn't given, I should say, for Chile in the last few minutes. I mean, this will be one of the main talking points in this entire qualification process, is how CONMEBOL referees are able to handle VAR. I mean, do you feel that that's something that can be fixed, or is it something that I think will take some time to get it improved on?
No, it can't be fixed. It's part of what it is. And those who thought that VAR was going to be the solution and it was going to do away with all controversy have been proved emphatically wrong. It just sets up a new forum for controversy. So that's not going to die away. I didn't see the second half of that game. I only saw the first half, and it surprised me what seems to have happened in the second half when Uruguay weren't as good as we might have expected, and Chile were better. With Uruguay, in a way, I think not having Cavani is not, you know, he's obviously a world-class player, but it frees them from the necessity to play 4-4-2, which can be a difficult system to balance out in the midfield. It means they can do other things. It means they can bring in a winger, Brian Rodriguez. It means they can bring in a playmaker, Arrascaeta, who's never looked entirely happy with playing wide in a 4-4-2, who won't play against Ecuador on Tuesday. So it means that they can look at other things, and their midfielders are very, very impressive. But the aspect of the team that I thought about is, you know, just looking at the lineup, he made an unbelievable mistake. Was, you know, he doesn't have Jimenez, who's now for me the leading centre back, and in the last World Cup qualification, Coates and Godin together were poor. And now, not a hope, you know, it's just too slow. It pushes the team back. It stretches out the team. And that maybe gave Chile the space to attack. So that's something that can't go on. Oh, you know, Jimenez does miss quite a few games with, and this isn't an injury. This is more COVID related. In the absence of Jimenez, I don't think he can dream of playing Godin and Coates together. He's got Araujo coming through at Barcelona, and this is the thing of Uruguay. The thing that to me makes the Chile-Uruguay game interesting, because Uruguay are the side, because of the excellence of their under-20 ranks, they're the side that is best managing the transition from one generation to another. And Chile, although some of the young players in what I saw did quite well, Chile are finding it very, very hard, as so many South American sides have done, you know, to replace a golden generation. I'd expect better from Uruguay going ahead, but you just can't. I don't think you can have Coates and Godin together. It's too slow.
Now, Tim, I want to jump in and head down to Buenos Aires and La Bombonera, where Argentina scored a 1-0 victory over Ecuador. For this match, you know, just looking back at the highlights and looking back at the statistics of the match, I was kind of surprised to see that Argentina only managed 2 shots on goal for the entire match and really relied on a penalty and a rightful penalty converted by Lionel Messi to give them the victory. Argentina's still a little, I would say, vanilla. You know, don't you think that in terms of they're not as flamboyant and as have as much flair as some of the other teams we've seen in South America? Is this concerning for Argentina as they move forward in qualifying?
I think they're better than they've been for a while. Although the big problem, the lack of defensive pace and quality, I think is still there. And Ecuador, the current Ecuador team, are not good enough to test that. But I think Argentina had a good 2019. Firstly, they came out of the Copa America as a team, with Messi deciding that if he's going to carry on with this, if he's going to play for Argentina, he's going to give it his all. So it was a different Messi in the Copa America. There was always dissatisfaction that he only ever spoke to Agüero in the Argentina camp, you know, and that kind of intimidated some of the other players. And then he emerges in the Copa America as a leader, as vocal, encouraging, talkative. In fact, he talked himself into trouble. Mm-hmm. But that was a big plus for Argentina. And then in the games subsequently, you know, the friendlies that we had second half of 2019, you began to see a team emerging, and vital to that was the introduction of Lucas Ocampos. Almost everything good that Argentina did on Thursday was Messi and Ocampos. Ocampos gives you so many things because he can play either wing, he's physically so strong, meaning that he can do defensive work as well. He'll work back. So that's a real find for Argentina. Now, for this game, they lost Giovanni Lo Celso, and Scaloni made a change. He brought in Acuña, and it changed the system. Instead, because Lo Celso would have played as one of the three in midfield with Paredes and Depaul, instead of which Acuña came in wide left, with Ocampos wide right, so it was and Messi able to float. So it was more like a 4-4-2, and it meant that the team didn't function because people were too far apart. The two wingers, together with two fullbacks, they're kind of occupying the same space. Depaul and Paredes are isolated from the rest of the team. The team worked best, actually, I thought, when Messi came back and made that third man in midfield and generated play. But that meant that the centre forward Lautaro Martinez was distant from the rest of the team, and they couldn't really bring him into the play. But the little flashes of Messi and Ocampos were very, very encouraging. So I think, to my surprise, with bearing in mind the inexperience of Coach Scaloni, I think they're moving in an interesting direction. But I do think there are the defensive problems have yet to be resolved, and I'm not a fan of Otamendi or Martinez Cuarta, the two centre backs, and not really of the fullbacks either. You know, they don't have a specialist defensive midfielder protecting them. Paredes is there more to start the moves than he is, you know, and he picks up lots of cards because the defending doesn't come naturally to him. Mm-hmm. So there are still problems there. I don't think we're going to learn anything on Tuesday against Bolivia, no, apart from whether they've prepared for the conditions of Bolivia, because it's a separate game, you know, and they're doing something different now. For a while, the idea was go up to altitude as close as possible to the kickoff. And from a physiological point of view, that means that it has less effect on the body. This time they're going earlier. So in physical terms, it might be worse, but in psychological and technical terms, it might be better because the players have more familiarity with the conditions and more of an idea of what they can do and what they can't do at the conditions of La Paz. But what happens there on Tuesday, it's not going to tell us that much about Argentina's strength in World Cup qualification. It's going to tell us how well Argentina have prepared for that particular game.
Now, one question I do want to ask you about Argentina going into that next match against Bolivia. One of the hottest players in world football right now would be Papu Gomez, you know, coming over from Atalanta. Atalanta have gotten off to a great start, and thanks in part, in major part, to his play. He did not see the pitch in this particular match against Ecuador. Does he get a chance against Bolivia on Tuesday?
Well, if it was the Ecuador game again, mm-hmm. why not put him in the midfield trio in place of Lo Celso rather than Acuña? Because, you know, Tagliafico at left back, he didn't need anyone in front of him. He could have filled that space. So if it was a normal game, especially at home to a more defensive side like Ecuador, I think that would be that would be worthwhile.
Yeah,
it's a possibility for Tuesday. But as I say, the planning has to be specifically for this game. You know, Bolivia have laid in wait for this game. Mm-hmm. They want 3 points. They're already calculating 3 points because any loss of points at home is a disaster for Bolivia. So you got to plan specifically for this game. And usually I tend to view that the best way to do altitude, you don't want to defend too deep because that's a disaster for your goalkeeper. You know, the shots from 30 yards can be a real problem with the way that the ball flies through the air. So you want kind of two compact banks of four, and you want speed merchants up front so you can attack with two players and give everyone else a breather and try and get your quick attackers behind their defensive line. So it's a game that I think calls for specific planning.
Mm-hmm. And I want to close out with the last match we didn't cover yet, and Papu Gomez's teammates in Luis Muriel and Duvan Zapata, and that's Colombia's 3-0 over Venezuela. Colombia, incredibly impressive in this match for me, and if it were not for the heroics of Wilker Fariñas, the young goalkeeper for Venezuela, this would have been 5-0, 6-0, and, you know, against the Venezuela side that, you know, when you look at the scoreline of the Brazil match, this Venezuela side is much stronger than the Bolivian side, and Colombia kind of had their way with them. What were your thoughts on really the attacking prowess that this Colombia side gave you on the weekend?
Yeah, you got to remember that the Venezuela coach met his players on Monday. Mm. So, you're judging teams that have spent very little time on the training ground. And I think Pizarro of Venezuela would admit he made a mess up with the starting lineup. They were far, far too open. And Dudamel had them defending pretty well with a kind of 4-1-4-1. You know, he had the three in central midfield. Pizarro gave up one of those three to have a player higher up, and it just left them way too open. So we have to take that into account. And Venezuela, their planning was not correct for this game. From Colombia, this is something that we saw last year from Queiroz, a double function of Cuadrado, which I think is important to the functionality of the team. You know, Cuadrado can come back and tuck back in and be a central midfielder just to the right of Wilmar Barrios. And then he can also be a right winger. And that double function enables James to roam inside, and that's important. And Queiroz took the big decision, which is he went with Duvan Zapata up front. Last year he often went with Falcao, with Radamel Falcao Garcia, and it just doesn't work, I don't think. I mean, Falcao doesn't, I don't think he's, he can't really play up front on his own in that way. I don't know, they've got Muriel wider. But I think Falcao is usually operated best when you've had a striker close to him. His back-to-goal work is not the best. But he's so emblematic in Colombia that it's difficult to drop him. But I think Queiroz got that decision absolutely right with big Duvan Zapata. So, yes, they were impressive. But, you know, that's something that Queiroz has been working on now for a while. You know, especially that double function of Cuadrado. And that obviously gave him a massive advantage over a Venezuela side where the coach had met the players on Monday. Yeah. And I'm intrigued now with Chile-Colombia because Chile, better than expected against Uruguay. Let's see how much they can test Colombia in Santiago.
No doubt about it. Tim, thank you again for coming on the show, joining us for our 300th episode. Always a pleasure to have you on, and we always look forward to having you back very, very soon, my friend.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And thanks again to Tim Vickery for joining us on the show. Rob, we have some great matches of the week coming up here, and we've got a full slate here. So let's get to it. On Tuesday, we go back to World Cup qualifying in CONMEBOL. Tim had mentioned the two matches that we are focusing on, and unfortunately, they are kind of at similar times. Peru-Brazil at kickoff at 8 p.m. and Chile-Colombia at 8:30 p.m. Going to be interesting to see both of those matches and see how those teams, especially Brazil and Colombia with such dominant performances on round one, to see how they come back on round two against some stiffer competition. Then on Wednesday in the Nations League, we have Italy and the Netherlands at 2:45 p.m. And then we go over to MLS, where Toronto FC and the New York Red Bull will kick off at 7:30 p.m. On Saturday, it is a massive slate. Starting 7:30 a.m. with the Merseyside Derby, Everton-Liverpool. And then we go to Germany for Hoffenheim-Dortmund at 9:30. Then we have the Milan Derby, Inter Milan-AC Milan at noon. And the afternoon matchup will be Getafe-Barcelona at 3 p.m. Sunday will close with two of the top three teams in Ligue 1. And it's Lille and Lens at 3 p.m. That's going to close out our week of matches. Rob, you had the trivia question, my friend. If you wouldn't mind giving it to me one more time, my friend.
Yes, so keeping into the discussion of our 300 episode, we decided to tie it in with Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo. And both these players, both of them playing at Barcelona and Real Madrid, respectively, scored their 300 career goal. But I just want you to tell me which year that they did it.
Which calendar year? I mean, obviously, I'm taking a guess and just trying to extrapolate from where they are now, where they're both north of 700. I'm going to go with 2013.
It is not 2013.
All right. I don't think it would be 14. I'll say 14, but then my last guess is going to be 12 if 14 is wrong.
So it's not 14, and you said your final guess is 12?
Yes.
2012?
Yes.
You're right. 2012.
I knew it had to be somewhere in that window, you know, obviously, but it's something that, you know, because you've got to add another 400 goals to each tally, which is a ridiculous number.
It's incredible, but yeah. Ronaldo scored his 300 career goal against Granada in 2012, and Messi against Rayo Vallecano in the same year. It's incredible. I mean, it's even incredible because both of them have a two-year age difference, and just how close they've been. And now look how far ahead they've done. I mean, 400 goals in 8 years. It's crazy.
Each.
Yes, that's right.
It's insane. So, again, testament to their greatness, right? So,
100%.
All right, my friend, without any further ado, let's hit the closing music and get started on the 300s for us.
Yes, let's do it.
All right, here we go. So, for episode 300 of Low Limit Football, special thanks again to Tim Vickery for joining us. Next week, we will review the CONMEBOL qualifiers again. We will look at the Nations League and where they stand. And we will look back on the leagues as they get ready to return to action. So, for episode 300 of Low Limit Football, I am Joe Uccello.
I'm Robert Rojas.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and good night.